You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, UW-Madison senior Sarah Nurse is a star hockey player. She's also one of the few black women active in the sport. We talk with her about her experiences.
First, manufacturing jobs were a hot topic in the presidential race and continue to be a priority for President Trump in his first days in office.
In his inauguration speech, President Trump said trade deals were letting other countries steal manufacturing jobs.
One by one, the factories shuttered and left our shores with not even a thought about the millions and millions of American workers that were left behind.
According to the Federal Reserve, U.S. manufacturing output is near a record high, while manufacturing jobs have been in major decline. In his farewell speech, President Obama pointed to another cause of the decline in manufacturing jobs, technology.
I agree, our trade should be fair and not just free. But the next wave of economic dislocations won't come from overseas. It will come from the relentless pace of automation that makes a lot of good middle-class jobs obsolete.
Our next guest has written a series of pieces about the impact of automation on manufacturing and other jobs in the United States and finds that technology is having a bigger impact than outsourcing. Claire Kane Miller joins us now. She's a correspondent for The Upshot in the New York Times, where she writes about gender, families, and the future of work. Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you looked, Claire, into a lot of economic analysis on this issue. When it comes to manufacturing job losses, what's the balance of blame between trade and technology?
So over the long term, it's not even close. Economists say automation and technology have had a much, much bigger impact than anything to do with globalization. One study that tried to pinpoint the numbers said it was about 87% the fault of automation and about 13% the result of things like trade and other parts of globalization.
Right. We hear sometimes over the years lately, we don't make anything in America anymore. But are we seeing sectors where production has stayed the same or even gone up while jobs went down?
Absolutely. Most manufacturing, like you said in the introduction, is at an all-time high. The steel industry is one example. It's lost 75% of its workforce since 1962. Production and shipments have not changed at all. And the reason is that robots are doing these jobs now.
So each individual worker who's still there is producing way more units. We're getting a lot more output per worker than we used to. So we need way fewer workers. That's the story in a nutshell, isn't it?
That's exactly right, because there are machines that are doing a lot of the stuff that workers used to do.
So who's hardest hit? The workers who don't have these jobs because of automation?
Right now, it's the people who had routine jobs. Those are the things that are the easiest to program a machine to do, things like loading items on to a conveyor belt or stocking items into regular-sized boxes, the kind of things that are unpredictable, that are very predictable work. Those are the things that have been automated so far in factories and manufacturing plants. But automation's affecting a lot of other jobs, too. If you think about, secretaries who used to spend a lot of time filing paper, now Microsoft Word does that for us. Or there's even robots who are administering anesthesia. So an anesthesiologist is a very highly educated, very highly trained doctor, obviously, and robots are even learning to do those jobs.
Well, and I look at things like ATMs affecting bank tellers, self-check lanes and grocery stores, maybe fewer jobs there. And this could be a big one in the future, driverless cars and all the jobs that involve driving, whether it's cars or trucks. This isn't a trend that's going to change anytime soon, is it?
Not at all. You're right that truck driving is the number one most common job in a lot of states and definitely under threat. The technology is already there. The thing about technological progress is it always moves forward. It doesn't really stall or move backward. And frankly, no one's really suggesting that it should. Mm-hmm.
Talking to Claire Kane Miller, she writes for the New York Times, the upshots there, talking about automation as a big factor, much bigger, a lot of economists say, most economists say, than trade in manufacturing and other job losses. So, Claire, in the past, we've seen new technologies come along, wipe out one kind of jobs, but create lots of opportunities, lots of new jobs. Are we seeing that happen this time around?
That is what technologists, the people who make this technology, and a lot of economists are really hoping will happen, because you're right, it's always happened in the past. People always use the example of buggy makers. They went out of business, but people got better jobs. Bank tellers, instead of just handing out money, they became financial advisors. That's a more highly skilled job. It pays better. It's considered a better job. So the hope is that's what will happen. But it's really too early to say. There are some signs that this time might be different. If you look at the things that machines are learning to do, it's now things that people thought would always be jobs for humans, like understanding emotions or doing unpredictable kinds of work. At the same time, wages have really stagnated, which some economists say points to the idea that this time could be different.
Even if it's not different, even in that best case scenario where new jobs come along, there's this situation where the people who have lost the old jobs can't just suddenly leap into those. What did you hear from economists about ways that we could be maybe helping people dislocated by automation?
Sure. And that's what the hardest part is, those people who are really left in the lurch. They're losing their jobs right now. Say they're in their 50s. They don't really have the time or the capacity to train for a new job and start a new career at this point. A lot of the suggestions have to do with making the safety net stronger. These are things like, providing better unemployment. The Obama administration put out a report right before the president left suggesting something like wage insurance, where if you lose your job in a factory where you made $20 an hour and the only job you can get makes $10 an hour, maybe there's some insurance that makes up the difference for you. Some of the most extreme ideas are things like a universal basic income, where everyone in a country gets a base salary out of an acknowledgement that some of these jobs are going away. But with the current political environment, it doesn't look likely that any of these things will necessarily happen soon.
Well, Claire, as you mentioned earlier, economists saying about 87%, I think was the number of manufacturing job losses, could be attributed to automation, as opposed to a much smaller amount for trade. In this presidential campaign, we heard a lot more about trade than we did about automation. Why are we focusing on what sounds like the much smaller problem?
It's much easier to say that another country is the villain than to say technology is the villain. We all, like to have our iPhones. Silicon Valley is in America. It is, this technology is benefiting the United States in many ways. And so even though it does have this negative side effect, this negative consequence, it's really much easier to cast other countries as a villain.
So even if we see success stories where places that had lost factories in the past get a factory back, it sounds like odds are that factory is going to employ much fewer people than the old one did.
The big example was Carrier, the company that Trump talked a lot about during his campaign. And right after he was elected, he convinced them through a lot of tax cuts, by offering them a lot of tax cuts, to not close down a factory they were going to close down in the United States. The CEO of that company said, "We are going to use these tax cuts to invest in automation." And he said, ultimately, that will mean fewer jobs for Americans. Nobody is trying to even hide this.
Do you see, you've talked obviously to economists who are raising this concern. Do you see people in the American political system paying enough attention to this issue of job dislocation and loss because of automation?
I think it really came up in this campaign because it can seem that it's divorced from a lot of voters, because these largely right now are jobs in factories and manufacturing, and those jobs are based largely in the Midwest. A little bit of coal mining, a little bit of timber in the Pacific Northwest, but it's not affecting everybody yet. So it really has become a major issue, though, especially when some people were surprised, who hadn't been affected by this by Donald Trump being elected. There are a lot of people out there whose careers, whose jobs, whose sense of being able to support their families and do what they trained to do their whole lives is really in jeopardy.
And Claire, as we wrap up, that's a huge question. What is the future of work? What would we have to do to solve this to make sure people dislocated end up with those jobs that can support families?
Well, one big answer that a lot of people point to is education. That's how we made the transition from a farming economy to an industrial economy. That's when people started going to high school because they needed to learn how to do these new kinds of jobs. We in the United States are falling behind other countries in educating our kids. The test scores are going down. The Obama administration, again, in that report it put out right before it left, said this starts as early as 4 years old, getting four-year-olds into high-quality preschool and getting more people with college degrees or at least vocational skills that they can do jobs in the new economy.
Claire, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Claire Kane Miller, correspondent for The Upshot in the New York Times. We've been talking about the impact of automation on jobs here in the United States.
Coming up, we visit with Badger women's hockey star Sarah Nurse about being one of just a few black women prominent in the sport. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Trump has called for an investigation into what he believes was widespread voter fraud in the 2016 election. We'll learn more about the investigation and what's at stake.
First, ice hockey has long been a sport with predominantly white players. But if you follow UW Badger women's hockey, the name Sarah Nurse is probably familiar, and she's one of a handful of players of color who are rising to the top of the game.
The UW-Madison senior is a forward on the women's hockey team and was described as a lethal scorer in a recent New York Times profile. In addition to playing with the Badgers and with the Canadian national team, she was drafted by the pro team, the Boston Pride of the National Women's Hockey League.
Sarah Nurse joins us now to talk about her experiences on and off the ice. Sarah, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, Sarah, sounds like you grew up playing a ton of sports because your family played all kinds of different sports. What made you pick hockey?
Yeah, I guess at the end of the day, hockey was one that I loved the most. It was one that I was probably the best at out of all of the other sports. But I think definitely growing up playing other sports, it definitely shaped me into the hockey player that I am today.
So you say you're probably better at hockey now that you've been playing it for a long time, getting close to playing professionally. Do you love it more, too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think through my experiences with hockey, there are so many places and people that I've met through hockey that I definitely wouldn't have if I played something else. So definitely hockey. It's been something that I've loved for a very long time.
Why do you think hockey has been, and still seems like for the most part, is so much less racially diverse than, say, basketball or baseball or American football?
Yeah, I think a few things. First, definitely the economics of it. It is an expensive sport to play. There's travel costs, there's equipment costs. You have to buy ice time. You can't just go down the block and find a basketball court. It's definitely expensive, so I think that's definitely a barrier. And I think the other one is just not having people to look up to. There are a few guys in the NHL of color, but there aren't many. And so I think if you look up in basketball and football, there are tons. So a lot of young kids want to play that, but in hockey, there's not so much.
Do you think that's something you're trying to do now is be that role model? So if there is a young woman out there, maybe a young woman of color who's thinking about playing, but she said, I look at these teams and they don't look like me, that they can see you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that it kind of just happened. It's not something that I set out to do when I started playing hockey, but I've definitely got it over the last 2 years saying, I look like you. I want to try this out too. So that's been very humbling.
Did you have role models when you were first getting started in hockey?
Not in women's hockey, just because it was so small when I started playing. They had the first world championship when I was 3 or 4 years old. So I definitely not in women's hockey, unfortunately. But I did look up to players like Jerome Iginla, George Barak. I think when I played NHL on PlayStation, they were always two players that were on my team. So that was very cool.
And you mentioned, that when you started playing hockey, women's hockey, it was very small. And I wonder what that was like for you being, at the beginning of a sport for women. And some women's sports are starting to get traction now, starting to pick up a viewership on TV. Things like basketball in the United States, for instance, is one of those. Do you think hockey is getting there?
I think so. It's becoming so much more popular. We were just in Columbus a few weeks ago at an NHL game, and a place like Columbus, you don't think hockey so much, but there was a very large crowd there, so we had a lot of fun. And I think we just played Tilt-A Bowl, and we had set a record for over 15,000 fans, so I definitely think the interest is in and that it's growing.
Was it any different in Canada? I have this syndrome. Maybe it's a stereotype of Canadians, but that Canadians live and breathe hockey, you know, in between eating maple pies and things like that, that this is part of your DNA. So was it any easier, do you think, in Canada, being a woman getting into hockey?
Maybe not a woman, but hockey in general. There are over 10 rinks in my city growing up, so hockey was definitely the sport that you played in the winter. I grew up playing with the boys. I played with the boys until I was 11 years old, and I didn't really know that there were girls' teams out there. So I think as girls are growing up now, we have girls' leagues that start when you're 5 or 6 years old, and I think that's really awesome.
So when you started, you were playing with the boys. This was not, there was not a women's team for you.
Right, yeah. I started off, I learned very much in my developmental years to play with the boys, again, up until I was 11. So that was really good for me.
Yeah, what was that like playing with boys? Do you think it changed the way that you play hockey at all, or do you think you'd be the same player either way today?
I'm not sure. I think that boys and girls were taught differently at that age. There's obviously body checking in boys hockey, so you definitely learn how to hit and how to take a hit. In girls hockey, there's no checking, so I think that was something that I would have missed out on if I didn't play boys hockey.
When I was growing up, and I'm older than you are, but there was a movie that I loved from the CBC. It was called Hockey Night, and it starred Megan Follows. That's this actress who was in an Anne of Green Gables, one of the first versions that hit it really big. And it was all about how she wanted to play hockey, and it's a Canadian movie. And she got a lot of pushback in this movie from being the first girl on this boy hockey team. Did mm-hmm. you ever feel like that? Did you ever have pushback and feel like maybe you didn't belong or it was hard?
I think definitely some other teams. I grew up playing with kind of the same guys throughout my boys' career, and so they kind of, I became part of their family, and they would put everything on the line for me as I would for them. Definitely with other teams, they kind of saw the ponytail, and they kind of pushed back on me a little bit, but at the end of the day, got through it, so it was good.
You know, what they say is, what doesn't kill you make you stronger. Do you feel like that, or was it really just a pain that you were being hassled a little bit by other teams?
I think it didn't bother me back then. I was just out there to play. I think it more bothered my parents. My mom definitely cringed every time I went in and somebody tried to hit me. But I think at that point, I was just trying to play hockey.
We're talking with Sarah Nurse right now. She's a Canadian ice hockey player and a forward on the Badger women's hockey team at UW. And she's with us now to talk about being a woman and a black woman in a predominantly white sport. And Sarah, you come from a family that has pretty elite athletes kind of all over the place. Your cousin Darnell Nurse skates for the Edmonton Oilers. Your cousin Kia Nurse is a champion college basketball player. What was it like growing up in a family that had such athletic prowess going on, where you had all these examples of great athletes?
We're all very close. There's definitely a lot of good examples to look up to. My aunts and uncles, my parents, for one. Definitely growing up, Kia, Darnell, and I are very close in age, so we played against each other in a number of sports. And so I think that was always really fun because we had that little bit of competition between us, but we're all very close. And at the end of the day, we are a family and we have a lot of fun together.
So does it mean you have a language of sports? I mean, if you talk about, you know, things that somebody else might not understand, what it feels like to skate into a rink against a really tough team, or having a day where you don't feel like you performed or you played your best, do you feel like having people who understand what that means has helped you out along the way?
Absolutely. There's definitely different experiences that we can pull from each other. We've all played in kind of high level sports, high level games, and so there's definitely that example from each other that we can take.
Now, it sounds like you were drafted by the Boston Pride and you're going to go on to play professional hockey when you're done at the UW. What do you think that experience is going to be like, that transition?
I'm not sure. Just from talking to some girls who are already in the league, it's a fast-paced league, very skilled. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the future holds.
And more recently, you and some UW athletes have come out publicly to confront racial incidents at the UW campus, like a person attending a Badger football game at Camp Randall who was dressed as former President Obama with a noose around his neck. That was a big story, and you spoke out about that. Why did you make that choice?
I think it was really important, just kind of seeing the reactions from my friends and from around the country, really, when that story picked up. A lot of people were very offended and very hurt. And so I think I have a bit of a platform. And so I think for me to speak out and kind of show that I wasn't happy with this and that it really wasn't okay. I just wanted to let everybody know that, really.
And when you talk about being a role model, seeing you speak out in that platform, are you starting to hear from younger girls, younger players even, who look to you and say, you know, you're someone that I'm following and I admire you and you're making a difference in my life?
Definitely, yeah. Especially through social media. I get tweets, I get messages very often, and they're just people who, you know, want to reach out, want to learn more about how they can get involved in hockey. Tell me that they've been following my career a little bit here at Wisconsin. And so it's definitely very humbling and something that I take a lot of pride in.
Now, I read that you're hoping for an Olympics bid in 2018. Is that right?
Yep, absolutely.
What would that call for? What do you need to do?
I guess right now we're kind of at the end of we're going into the third year of the Olympic cycle with Hockey Canada. And so they've seen a lot of me over the last 3 years. And so I think now it's kind of a waiting game. It's up to them who they want to bring. So we're going to have to see.
And apparently the 2018 Olympics are going to be in Canada. Is that right?
No, they're actually in Korea.
Oh, in South Korea. Right. Yeah. Well, so tell me what that would mean for you to be picked if this does all work out for you.
It'd be very cool. A dream come true, really. I think when you, as a women's hockey player, you can't play in the NHL, so you don't look up and think, yeah, I want to play professional hockey as a 10-year-old. You look up and you see the Olympics and you see these girls winning gold medals and people cheering for them, and that's someplace that you want to be. So definitely be a dream come true.
And as we wrap up here, Sarah, is there a message you want to leave to young girls who are maybe hanging back and not really having the courage to go after these sports they want to take part in? What would you tell them?
I think I would just say don't let anybody tell you that you can't do anything. I think if I would have let people say you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't play this, I wouldn't be where I am today. And so I definitely think if you want to do something, you may as well do it.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you.
Now, Sarah Nurse, a Canadian ice hockey player and a forward on the Badger women's hockey team at the UW, and she joined us to talk about her involvement in hockey and her experience as a Black woman in a predominantly white sport.
Coming up, we'll talk about President Trump's call for an investigation into voter fraud, which he says cost him the popular vote. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it is True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, a brand new doctor struggles working the night shift, a mailman joins Mr. Rogers' neighborhood, and a child spends her birthday at Coney Island in 1957. That's coming up tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, amid a slew of executive orders and announcements this week, President Trump called for the government to launch an investigation into what he believes was widespread voter fraud in the 2016 presidential election.
He alleges that millions of votes were cast illegally in the election and that those fraudulent votes cost him the popular vote. This is a claim that has been debunked, but it has raised questions about whether or not voter fraud is a major issue, should be taken seriously in the United States.
Donathan Brown is with us. He's an associate professor in the Communication Studies Department at Ithaca College, and he's also a Fulbright recipient and author of Voting Rights Under Fire, The Continuing Struggle for People of Color. Donathan, welcome to Central Time.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Well, President Trump made the announcement this week that he would like to see an investigation into voter fraud, and he was asked about it on ABC World News Tonight host David Muir in his first interview after the inauguration. Here's a little bit of that conversation.
You have people that are registered who are dead, who are illegals, who are in two states. You have people registered in two states. They're registered in a New York and a New Jersey. They vote twice. There are millions of votes, in my opinion. Now, I'm going to do an investigation.
You're now president of the United States.
When you say it's, and I want the voting process to be legitimate.
But now, when you say, in your opinion, millions of illegal votes, that is something that is extremely fundamental to our functioning democracy, a fair and free election.
Sure.
You say you're going to launch an investigation into this.
Sure, done.
What you have presented so far has been debunked. It's been called false.
Take a look at the Pew reports.
I called the author of the Pew report last night, and he told me that they found no evidence of voter
fraud.
Really?
Then why did he write the report?
He said no evidence of voter fraud.
Excuse me. Then why did he write the report, according to Pew report? Then he's groveling again. You know, I always talk about the reporters that grovel when they want to write something that you want to hear, but not necessarily millions of people want to hear or have to hear.
So you've launched an investigation.
We're going to launch an investigation to find out. And then the next time, and I will say this, of those votes cast, none of them come to me. None of them come to me. They would all be for the other side. None of them come to me. But when you look at the people that are registered, dead, illegal, and two states, and some cases maybe three states, we have a lot to look into.
And Donathan, a clip there between Donald Trump, President Trump, and ABC World News Tonight host David Muir. What do you hear in that clip we just listened to?
Sure. Well, there's a series of things that we see initially Sean Spicer mentioned that Donald Trump repeated. And this is kind of boils down to at least a couple of things. One is that there's a 2008 Pew study showing that 14% of people who voted were non-citizens. First, there is no study that shows 14% of the votes cast in 2008 were cast by non-citizens. That would have had to be in the area of 18 million fraudulent votes. Second, the 2008 Pew study that Sean Spicer mentioned and Trump repeated was actually published in 2012 and makes zero mention of non-citizen voting or even registering to vote. In fact, the report is entitled Inaccurate, Costly, and Inefficient, Evidence That America's Voting Registration System Needs an Upgrade. And for us, this report is about record keeping and nothing about fraud. So when we consider the totality of the situation and going back to the author of the Pew report, which was interviewed on CNN, this simply is another claim without merit.
So when we talk about voter fraud, what exactly does that term refer to? What action?
Well, oftentimes when you hear the term voter fraud, it is, as Trump mentioned, individuals who are casting more than one ballot. So you vote in one municipality or one state and you cross the border or line into another state or another municipality and vote again. And this is what typically nowadays is what oftentimes referred to as voting twice / voter fraud.
And when you're talking about some of these other things you said, people who may have passed away, be dead, they may still be on the voting rolls. People who are registered in two states. So you're saying this is more about the voting rolls and the currency of them as opposed to the act of fraud. Is that right?
Yeah. So what I'm taking away from a lot of this is that when we talk about voter registration versus voter fraud, we're making two huge leaps without any sort of evidence. So, for instance, I think Trump is correct in that we should look more into accurate voter registration rolls. However, to take that claim on registration rolls and somehow inflate it to millions of people voting illegally, it's just something that has no merit to date.
Trump also, in that bit of interview we heard, he said that these votes, the fraudulent votes, they were all for the other side, presumptively Hillary Clinton he's talking about there. They were not for him. How does that strike you?
It strikes me in two levels. One is that how, without evidence, can anyone claim that these so-called illegal votes swung the election one way or the other? So, for instance, in that interview, Trump mentioned that none of these votes went to me. Well, how do we know? What evidence exists to even suggest that claim? And secondly, is the part that we hear often, is that individuals who commit voter fraud by means of voting twice typically vote for Democrats. Again, another claim without merit, but you can see the same echo chamber repeating itself.
We're talking with Donathan Brown right now from Ithaca College. He's also the author of Voting Rights Under Fire. And we're talking right now about Donald Trump's call for an investigation into what he believes was massive voter fraud in the 2016 presidential election. And Donathan, do you think that this the call of voter fraud by President Trump is a way to get at the issue of who won the popular vote?
Yeah, you know, what I'm thinking is that losing the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by nearly 3 million votes exposes him to questions over his political legitimacy, whether or not he really has a mandate from the people, for instance. As it stands now, we see that Donald Trump has the lowest first job approval rating, somewhere around 45%, according to Gallup, for any new president since Harry Truman in 1945, when the data was initially collected. Put another way, no one has entered the Oval Office with a lower approval rating since 1945 than Donald Trump. So when we hear continuous claims about Trump losing the popular vote due to illegal votes, in my opinion, in my mind, this is more so a question about political legitimacy and searching for a mandate from the people, more so than about fraud itself.
Now, looking at that, another issue that was brought up in that bit of interview we listened to, David Muir got at the fundamentals of democracy and legitimate elections. Now, people who agree with President Trump may say, well, we need to be assured that our elections are legitimate. This is an underpinning of democracy. And people who are critical of his claim of fraud might say, well, you're casting one of the bedrocks of democracy into doubt, and that may be dangerous. What do you think about that question?
Sure. I can see it in two different ways. First, I agree with the understanding that we need to be reassured as we are, and this is a funny idea about it, is that you hear the claim that we need to be reassured that the ballot box is protected. Well, it's worth mentioning that elections are administered at the local level. So there are reports produced by the states, by officials such as the Secretary of State, who, of course, certifies the election in the state, who, of course, looks into claims about voter fraud. Just recently, for instance, two Republican Secretaries of State in Louisiana and Ohio have come forth to say within the past 24 hours that upon addressing this claim, widespread voter fraud simply does not exist.
And in that, President Trump seems a bit isolated in what he is saying, alleging voter fraud between 3 and 5 million. Is there a contingent that agrees with him at this point?
It's interesting because when you take a look at recent comments, either by Paul Ryan, by Lindsey Graham, for instance, they all continue to dispute the president on this claim. The idea that we have 3 million, 5 million illegitimate votes is beyond reconcile in the fact that when pushing for evidence, when asking questions, we're not finding much to go for. In the sense of this, one of the key questions that's come up time and time again is how common is voter fraud? And we can look at studies, for instance, a 2015 report from the Conservative Heritage Foundation found that less than 12 individual cases of non-citizens have been convicted of registering or actually voting since 2000. There are reports out of Arizona State University and others that continually find that voter fraud is virtually non-existent. So again, it's one of those stories that I'm interested to see how it plays out.
We're talking with Donathan Brown right now about President Trump's call for an investigation into what he believes was massive voter fraud in the 2016 presidential election. Donathan is an associate professor in the communications department at Ithaca College.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there should be an investigation reaction to this allegation of massive voter fraud. What do you think about says about President Trump that he's calling for this investigation? While it's been pointed out there's no evidence for voter fraud at anywhere near that scale, what do you think could be gained? What do you make of this whole conversation that's going on this week? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. And we're talking with Donathan Brown. He's an associate professor in the Department of Communications at Ithaca College, and he's also the author of the book Voting Rights Under Fire, The Continuing Struggle for People of Color.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the president's claim of widespread voter fraud? Do you think there needs to be an investigation? Would you like to see the president keep talking about this or move on to other things? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We've got Doug on the line first in Stevens Point. Doug, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
The quickest thing I was going to say was that the best lies use the truth. And I didn't know if he's looking into voter fraud from a specific angle that it should be something that's helping him. Is there anything that he may find in Wisconsin with the ideas of the voter registration tax that have happened in Wisconsin? Is it possible he could find something and then bury it, and then it couldn't be investigated later on because under his administration it's looked at once and there's some sort of double jeopardy sort of thing?
Doug, thank you for that call and some questions relating to Wisconsin there, Donathan. What sorts of things could this investigation yield and how could the findings be used?
Well, my opinion is that the investigation, however massive or grand scale it is, will find very little. And in doing so, it cannot be used to do much, considering the fact that 32 states now have some form of voter identification law requiring voters to produce proof, photographic proof, to verify their identity before casting a vote. So when I think about places like Wisconsin and other states that have voter identification laws, there's one piece of this puzzle I cannot necessarily answer, and that's simply the details surrounding the investigation to be announced, in the sense that how will this investigation take place, who will oversee it, amongst other details, are often, unfortunately, remain to be seen.
Thank you for that call, Doug. And we move next to Lori joining us in Altoona. Lori, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for the show. I have two questions, and it sounds like one, the person on the show is having the same question as who will conduct the investigation and how will they ensure that both parties are being investigated.
Okay.
But my bigger question is who is going to pay for it specifically?
Okay, a couple good questions are from Lori. Lori, thanks for that. And Donathan, do you have a handle on sort of the who and the how is it going to be paid for?
I do not. Like the caller, I too have questions about the way or the manner in which this investigation will carry out. I'm not sure, like many people, how this will take place. So I guess we're all in this wait-and-see type of moment.
Have we ever seen a proposed investigation that actually proceeded on the scale that this could be? And we're talking about something that would be nationwide, 50 states. That's a lot of ground to cover.
It is. It is. And we've seen different studies before. I mean, the way I look at it is that I cannot recall in recent memory a president going to this length on the issue of voter fraud. I mean, as I mentioned before, elections are administered at the local level, so there are reports produced by the states. For instance, you know, when we talk about the 2012 study, for instance, out of Arizona State University, they analyzed nearly 2,100 alleged election fraud cases since 2000 and concluded that voter fraud is virtually non-existent. As I mentioned, the 2015 Heritage Foundation report found that less than 12 individual cases of non-citizens convicted of registering or actually voting since 2000. When we look at Texas, between 2002 and 2014, of the 72 million votes that were cast in that 12-year period, 85 cases of possible fraud were flagged, Of those 85, only four stood the test of time for a conviction. So you have four convictions of 72 million. So you can see the math here doesn't necessarily support widespread voter fraud.
Laurie, thanks again for that call and your kind words about the show. And we go next to Joy in Eau Claire. Joy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I find this issue to be one, just a major distraction to the other issues going on that are to me a little more important. But my other question is, how many people, because of the voter ID law, did not vote because of the new, because of the photo IDs? How many votes did not get cast because of that law? And would he have possibly even lost the election had those people not been, I mean, how many more people voted when that wasn't a law?
Joy, thank you for the call. And Donathan, do we know how many people may not have voted due to voter ID laws?
There are estimates that exist, and they are simply that, estimates. I cannot give any concrete numbers to that simply because I do not know. The caller, I think, is absolutely correct that this goes to a question about harm with respect to voter identification laws. Who's left behind from voting as a result of such laws? If you take a look at Texas and North Carolina, for instance, recent court decisions paint the picture pretty well. In both instances, the court found in striking down both laws that, one, sufficient evidence existed that such laws discriminated against African Americans, Latinos, and those of lower income brackets, and two, insufficient evidence existed that in-person voter fraud is, in fact, as widespread as some individuals continue to claim. So I think the caller is absolutely right. I wish I had a more definitive answer on the numbers, but I think that's something worth continuing.
And Joy, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking right now with Donathan Brown from Ithaca College, talking about President Trump's call for an investigation into what he alleges is widespread voter fraud, perhaps 3 to 5 million votes in the 2016 election. And we go back to our callers. Now we have Larry with us next in Hillsborough. Larry, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to ask?
It's kind of an observation standpoint. It kind of goes, you know, he's putting this out there, and voter fraud, I think everybody could agree, probably does exist. There may be one or two cases in each state, but not the millions that he's talking about. The other thing, I think he's just using it as a distraction from his executive orders. I mean, you don't hear about, again and again, him signing, you know, and approving the pipeline. You don't hear about him, you know, getting rid of Obamacare, because all you're hearing about is voter fraud, voter fraud, voter fraud. I think it's just distracting the American people. And it's a way for him to try and become equal with the Democrats and this whole Russian scandal that came out.
Larry, thank you for that call. And Larry thinks it's a distraction from other things, perhaps willfully, Larry is saying. And what do you say, Donathan?
There are so many things going on right now with the new administration. You know, I think Larry is correct in so far as some of these things can be understood as distractions from larger issues. So I do not disagree with him on that. But again, you know, one of the things I'm very curious about in so far as this investigation is how this will play out in the long term. Will we see an elevated rise in states who will attempt to pass bills requiring photo identification laws? So, I mean, in the short term and the long term, there are a lot of ideas to be pounced around. There are a lot of things to wait for. But I agree with Larry. There are so many things going on, and this can easily be perceived as a distraction.
And Donathan, in our last 30 seconds or so, you mentioned voter ID laws. A number of states are in the process of putting these on the books, including Wisconsin this time around. Could an investigation like this yield something like a national voter ID law?
I'm not too certain about that, particularly with recent court decisions that I mentioned in both Texas and North Carolina. One of the things that I am fearful about is as the Voting Rights Act was struck down as it was in that manner, how we will begin to regain voting rights. How will we begin to address accessing the ballot for people all across the country? So, again, it's one of my concerns, and I hope it plays out well.
Donathan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank Thank you for having me.
That was Donathan Braun, associate professor in the Department of Communications at Ithaca College, also the author of Voting Rights Under Fire. He joined us today to talk about President Trump's call for an investigation into what the president believes was widespread voter fraud in the 2016 election, claim that has been widely debunked.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup. We'll check out Governor Walker's latest announcements about public assistance and other top stories.
We'll hear about a project in Brown County that teaches teens about jobs and businesses by running a farmers market program.
And on Food Friday, eggs. We eat a lot of them. They can get boring. Our guest will zest up our egg recipes.
That's all coming up tomorrow on Central Time.
Weekday mornings from 6 to 9, it's the Joy Cardine Show. Tomorrow after 7, Donald Trump is withdrawing the United States from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and more changes in trade policy are expected. Joy gets two perspectives on the issue tomorrow morning after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then a look at an audit that indicates the Wisconsin Department of Transportation significantly underestimated the real costs of several highway projects. We'll find out how this could impact transportation infrastructure and the taxpayer. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.